Are you a leader in customer success, pre-sales, professional services, support? Do you work behind the scenes and roll up your sleeves to make sure that customers are happy? Renew. Then this is for you. Welcome to the GSD Podcast.
Welcome to the GSD Podcast.
Getting it done. Services, success, and software. We'll talk with the pros that have been in the trenches, getting service teams off the ground, launching new types of groups to service customers, or running agencies that don't have a product attached to it. For the pros, by the pros.
This is the GSD Podcast, and this is your host, Jeff Kushmerick.
Hello there. Thanks for listening, as always. This is Jeff. Really enjoyed this episode I've been trying to get for a while. And it's a real deep dive, you could say, from the trenches of scoping from the technical perspective. But the interesting thing is talking with Randy, CEO of a dev shop in Kentucky, and as much as you want to get into some of the technical stuff, it really does trace back to the business requirements, and we get into some of the different ways we can flesh those things out, agile versus waterfall, in ways that we can guarantee our customers that we're not trying to screw them. Because this is what, I mean, I'm never trying to do that. But sometimes it can seem like we're trying to do that by putting up guardrails or being conservative. So we got into that for a while, and we really took a nice deep dive, and we went into a use case too, which is really nice. Some people, you know, are sometimes afraid to go down that area, but we definitely went deep into it today. So give it a listen. You know, if you listen, if you scope products, if you buy products or services, it's definitely a well worth listen. I think Randy really knows what he's talking about, and I was along for the ride. So enjoy. Thank you. On this computer. All right, we're recording. So Randy, thanks for joining. I appreciate it. And let me talk about my dog there for a minute and why we started late. But
yeah, sure, no problem.
So why don't you tell me a little bit about yourself, where you're located, and then we're going to get into the topic of the day after that.
Yeah, so my name's Randy Searing. I own a software development company called Level 12. Our office is out of the Louisville, Kentucky area, but I'm, you know, at least half of our people are remote now, and even the people who are geographically close to us, most of us work out of the office. So we have clients that we had, you know, in the local area, but we also have clients, you know, around the US. I've been doing software development since roughly late 2004.
Okay.
I started out as a freelancer, just trying to put myself through seminary, actually.
Oh, wow. Okay.
That's how I came to the Louisville area.
Yeah.
Around 2009, I get a guy from my church telling me, "Hey, you really aren't cut out to be a pastor.
You probably don't
want to do that. You know, go be faithful in a local church, but don't go be a pastor." And so that was good advice. He told me why, and I listened. He had some good things to say. And I was finishing up my seminary degree, and I never really intended at that time. I had a part-time guy working for me doing software development, helping me. And I never really intended to run a business. I never saw myself as a business owner, but I've just been trying to be faithful with what the Lord has put in front of me. And so 2004, we had the company, I kind of merged with a partner in 2009. We did some networking and small business computer consulting, as well as software development at that time. I actually thought the software development stuff was going to die. I had a real hard time, you know, finding new work.
Yeah.
And then we had a couple strategic relationships develop. And so I never really went over and helped him with that side of the business. And then in 2013, we realized that software development was really, you know, the better business. Mm. And so we actually sold off the other part of it. And since 2014, we've focused exclusively on software development. So I've personally been focused on software development, building software development for small and medium businesses, throughout that time. Although honestly, we have some large enterprises. One of our clients is a Fortune 500. You know, right. Another one is hundreds of millions, not billions. Yeah. But we do have a prospect in the queue. For an aerospace company that's, I think a couple billion in revenue. So we certainly span the gamut in terms of the customer type, the industry, and also the size. It's interesting that you can do that. You know, normally you'd try to segment, but right. What I've found is that so many different businesses have the ability to have a good ROI on software development. Mm-hmm. Not all of them, obviously, and you have to be able to afford it because it can get, it can get expensive. The key is really just to make sure that the problem you're solving, has more return on investment than what you're going to spend.
Absolutely.
To do the software project, and so that's key. You know, a lot of people don't think about it that way, so we try to educate them in that respect. But a lot of them think you're just trying to sell them.
I know. Tell me about it.
My perspective is really like our entire sales philosophy is designed around discoverability. So what is the problem that the customer has or the client, the prospect has? We try to understand the business value of it because not all of our clients are really willing to adopt that mindset.
Right.
But we know how quickly software can get complex. We know how quickly the bills can add up.
Yep.
And so we are trying to do the due diligence on the front side to make sure that we're trying to get a sense of scope and how that impacts the client's P&L to make sure that, we're getting into a project that there really is a good.
No, 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 absolutely. Because, you see this so often, where if people don't have, if they say, hey, we want to go build some stuff, and then like 6 weeks into the project, they'll be like, oh, we need to go this now, we need to do this now. And you and I know if the project fails, we're not getting brought back in at all. And it's a bad mark on, your referenceability. And I'm not going to say like we're doing the Challenger sale or anything like that, but when requirements start going a little sideways, you're like, well, how is this impacting, or you pull up the problem statement from the first week and you're just basically like, you stated we're building this to be increase X, Y, and Z. And then you get a couch. You're like, I don't know your business as well as you do. Can you tell me what that is? And you're like, oh, okay. Yeah. This and that. Before we go down that path a little bit more.
Sure.
So I believe, and apologies if I'm wrong here, you focus a lot on Python projects. Is there more than that? Are you sort of software agnostic, or is that sort of a niche that you're working on?
Yeah, so I usually don't go into a conversation talking about the fact that I use Python because I'm usually talking to people that just, A, they might not even know what that is, and B, they just don't care.
Okay.
I'm really talking, I solve business problems with custom software. The reality is behind the scenes, on the back end, I almost exclusively use Python. And I do that primarily because I find that the greatest constraint in the software development process is the availability of quality software development.
Oh, 100%, right.
And so because I'm optimizing for how much my developers can get done, how productive they are, it means that I pick tools that allow us to get a lot of value out of the developer.
Gotcha.
And so I actually gear my entire process, project management, the way we run our sprints, the fact that we use Python on the back end, the fact that we use React on the front end, all of those decisions are made to try to reduce the amount of cruft a developer has to deal with to put business value together in the software.
Yeah.
And
I can see that a lot with your small to medium-sized customers. What I've bumped into on that, I got two things.
Sure.
And just purely conversational. When we're dealing with enterprise customers, it seems like when you eventually transition the technology to them, like we're not even doing Rails stuff anymore because people are like, we can't find Rails developers, right? And so if it's not Java or .NET, most of the enterprises don't want us to build in a technology. Python we love, but I'm just laughing because all the Python developers that we have, they're like, no, if we're not doing machine learning stuff now, we don't want to, you know, they don't want to do regular web development stuff. But that's more cultural and where our developers are located and things like that. So they're like, oh, why am I going to be doing like a portal when I can go be cranking out AI and machine learning and stuff like that? So, but no, Python's an amazing thing, and there's some really big companies here in Boston that they've sucked up all the Python developers in the area. They have them all. So, but that's great. And I like how you approach it for the business value and stuff like that. On that note, I wanted to start transitioning into sort of the topic of the day, and it's perfect because we can paint myself as the sales guy, and maybe, and I know you do sales and for your company or help out or you get brought into the process. But as a technical resource, there's always a little bit of back and forth, right? Because and it's, you know, I would think for anybody that's listening to this podcast, they're not of the sales type where they're just trying to use pressure and push people down. It's usually they've got some people that are in a pinch and they're looking for a quote. Like that's, you know, if you're ever trying to get into the why of somebody like me, it's I'm getting asked like, hey, I'm in a pinch. I need some people. You know, and we're always getting asked cost, right?
Yep.
But I know that's hard. I'd love to hear your approach, and then we can get into methodologies and ways to structure projects and things like that. But you know, what's the scenario usually is like, hey, Randy, I just got off the phone with these people. They get this big project starting, you know, hopefully in like 2 weeks. So they were wondering if we could go in, do a quick scope, and then, you know, get going. I don't know, stop me if this sounds familiar, but now I come from more large enterprise type projects where my teams basically say, unless we do 8 weeks of discovery and come up with the software design and, you know, all API structures and, you know, project plan and scope matrices and things like that, we don't get involved. I'd like to hear A, where you are in that sort of spectrum, and then B, how do you solve this, you know, annoying sales guy who's just asking you for a quote.
Yeah. So let me say that I think it starts a step back, maybe even with just the general philosophy of software development. And so, if the listeners are familiar, you know, there's a general debate going on out there about the waterfall method versus the agile method. So the difficulty that I have is agile has been commercialized. There was a talk last year. I can't remember the name of the guy right now off the top of my head. Martin Fowler. He talked about the state of agile. And he basically said it's become an industrial complex.
Oh, absolutely.
Agile has. And so when you hear agile now, it's like you need a team of consultants to do agile. If you go back to simply the Agile Manifesto, you go back to the principles that they laid out in the Agile Manifesto. Essentially, what they're describing is software is a process that, by its very nature, resists a tight scope and tight deadline.
Yep.
This does.
Yep.
And, you know, and business people hear this and they often, they want to immediately eject from the conversation because they feel like they're getting sold a bunch of BS.
Yep.
But the reality is that I would encourage any business person who has to engage either their own software developers or is looking to hire, I would say, look, please spend a couple of days reading good resources, not about the industrial complex agile, but about the Agile Manifesto and the reasons why it was created, the underlying concepts, why they believe that this is the approach to software development.
Yep.
And at its heart, I think what it's boiled down to me is you have to recognize that software is fundamentally a discovery process. Mm-hmm. When we sit down with everybody in the room and they, you know, we start to do scoping, there are things that the software developers will run into as they start to build this process that nobody in the room could have known they would run into. Because there is hidden complexity. Mm-hmm. There are things that by their very nature will not be discovered until you get to actually doing the work.
Absolutely.
And run into the problem.
Yep.
So A great analogy I've heard is it's kind of like trying to build a road. If you're building a road and you have to dig through, you know, a hill, you know, interstates, they often dig through hills because they don't want too much, too much pitch in the road. So you dig through the hill, you think, you know, you're in an area where you're mostly going to hit dirt. Well, if you get halfway through and you hit solid rock and you realize that the dirt's, the dirt's not 10 feet thick like you thought it was, it's actually only 2 feet thick. And oh yeah, you did drill some, you know, you drilled some pilot holes, but it turns out you just didn't drill them in the right place.
Yep.
Well, nobody sitting there knows that you're going to hit that rock except the people who actually start the project and then get halfway through and hit the rock.
Absolutely.
So, thinking about this, you know, in the business context, what this really means is that as a software developer, I'm sitting there essentially trying to convince people, A, I can't really give you fixed cost, fixed estimate if you want to fix the scope, because nobody's built this, like I'm a software development professional and I have really good software developers on my team. But what I know is that nobody has actually gone down this particular road and built it for you, because if they had, you'd have what you need.
Right.
So every custom development project, even if it's very similar in nature to other things I've done, is going to be, it's going to be new.
Yeah.
If it wasn't that way, then there would be a vendor solution available. If what you
absolutely
need,
if that's exactly it
out there already,
yep,
then you would just be able to buy it off the shelf theoretically, or you'd be able to buy it from a competitor, but they're not going to want to sell it for you to you because they want you.
I get it. Do you believe in the value of sort of going in there and doing like a 4-week discovery process? And I'm for discovery. I do feel that you do have to couch it right. In my experience, unless you do a really long thing. And by the way, on the whole agile versus waterfall, like if you're building enterprise software for people, you still need to do a little upfront work, right? Because everything my teams have come in and fixed over the last couple of years have been science projects that got successful and they didn't plan, the metaphor that I always use too for the situation that you're talking about is easy, because my dad was a plumber, and I would say, you would never have the plumbers, the carpenters, the electricians, and the painters all show up to the asphalt lot on day one and just say, get after it. You guys are pros. You'll know what to do, right? That you need a little bit of a plan and kind of go from there. I have found that, you know, if you go in even for like 3 weeks, you know the size of the team, right? You're like, you know what? This is going to be you always need a project manager and some type of technical lead, back end, front end, QA. Like, it's not going to get smaller than that. I think I've said that 10 times this week. But we can find out how long it's going to take, if there's going to be spikes in resources. But you're right. Like, you might uncover just so much technical debt, or missing requirements or stuff like that. So I'd love to hear you sort of, now that I've given my take, your next steps in that, in how you like to go about doing it to ensure sort of happy clients, successful project and things.
Yeah. So Eisenhower said, in preparing for battle, I've always found that plans are useless, but planning is indispensable.
Yeah.
So I think it's important to recognize a lot of companies want you to come in and do all that work so you can say, okay, this is when the software is going to be built, this is when it's going to be done, and this is how much it's going to cost.
Yeah.
And I think the better approach for a business person to take is to say, what I'm really doing in that process is evaluating whether or not I actually want to work with this company.
That's exactly it. How are the questions that they asked? I hear that constantly now, especially now that everything's getting a little bit more commoditized. Like, I love the questions that you asked, you know? So
yeah.
Sorry, so stop talking so you can talk.
No, you're good. That's exactly right. So my suggestion to a business person trying to evaluate either the development of a software project, finding a consultant or whatever, is essentially, do they come out of the backside of that client's initial consultants, do they come out of the backside of that process feeling a lot more confident in their understanding of the project and what they actually need? Do they feel like they just got sold for 2 weeks? You know, like there should be a tangible difference between I feel really confident that the project's in a better place. And I feel like I don't know anything more than I did that 2 weeks ago. I just feel like these guys have built me for 2 weeks, you know, like, so I think that's a good, you know, that's a good, one of the good indicators for the, you know, potential client or the prospect business person trying to figure all this stuff out, especially if they've not done it before.
Yeah.
In terms of our process, it really depends on the size of the client and the project. So I actually don't, you know, you described, you know, kind of your team size, your base team size. For our projects, we don't necessarily need something that big. They might not actually need that many developers. We have true full stack developers. And so for some projects, we might actually just put two full stack people in the project. We might realize that most of what they need is basic UI. We have kind of basic UI libraries that we use for a lot of our stuff, so that we don't have to involve UI UX people. And so we can usually get a really good 80% solution. Nice. That's great for business, to, you know, a general business process.
You can use like, and I'm not, and this is terrible because my company does React, but like, I don't know what the, like the Twitter bootstrap version of that, you know, React has, but like, is this good enough? Right. You know,
that's exactly what it is. Yep, yeah. Bootstrap. That's exactly it. Right. Yeah. And so, and yes, by the way, they do have React bundling for that. So we absolutely try to, you know, shave out some of those things that for 9 out of 10, you know, business projects, I personally don't find all of that needed. And then if it is needed, because we're not putting together on-site teams, we're actually owning the project.
Yep.
I can just bring in those resources from my team as needed. Like I might go, oh, so this is going to have some custom DevOps stuff. I don't need a DevOps person on the team.
Right.
I just need to bring in that resource from the other part of my, from the other part of my company, schedule them to work two weeks on the project to get the skeleton in place. And then my full stack devs can take over, you know, actually doing the deploys and
stuff.
Nice.
So, that's nice and light. I like that. That's good.
Yeah. So getting back to the kind of the fundamental, how do you approach kind of the project management discovery process? Well, I've had some clients. So first of all, we offer a 100-hour guarantee. So you can essentially work with us for 100 hours. And if you feel like I've sold you something that I'm not, you can ask me for the money back. If you ask me for all of it back, you can't keep anything. You can ask for a 50% refund and I'll let you keep whatever we've put together. And hopefully we'll part as friends, just realizing that for whatever reason, it wasn't a good match.
Yep.
So first of all, I have some clients that have relatively smaller projects or projects that they're really confident they can get ROI in, but they don't want to go through the process of a really big scope. Like they just want to get moving. And so I've had clients like that, that just say, let's go ahead and start moving. You know, a lot of times those clients have got personal referrals from people we've worked with. So there's a lot of trust initially.
Yeah.
And they just say, look, I trust you guys. Let's get started. Let's do the discovery process as part of the working
project. Just get going. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. Like, so I'm doing that discovery towards, you know, the initial delivery, whatever that initial delivery is. And so we just kind of get off to the races as soon as we can put them in our schedule.
Yeah.
The complete other end of the spectrum for me, would be a more enterprise, prospect. You know, we have one of those in that aerospace company I mentioned. Mm-hmm. So what that looked like is we had a number of video calls with them initially to just even try to understand where they were at. Is this a good match? We had a couple of tech discovery calls to look at the software. They had an access database, essentially, that solution that they had outgrown. You know, they had a guy in house build that, you know, it worked. It got them what they needed, but there was obviously there's bugs. The guy had moved on. They weren't able to really edit it anymore, and so all that to say, they were able to show us, but it was a really complex piece of software. It sat at the intersection of a lot of the different departments in their business. There was a lot of business levels, software aside, there was a lot of business complexity in what this application was doing for them.
Yep.
So we flew down to their location so that we could go on site and meet them. That was before they paid us anything. Like, we just recognized this is a good long-term prospect.
Yep.
If they can actually use what we do, this is worth investing in the relationship. So we flew down there, spent a day with them, just again going through the software, talking to the different people in the different departments and what that piece of software meant to them. Because that's, you know, that's really important to get the different types of users in the discussion. They engaged us for a $5,000, you know, engineering phase, which is, you know, relatively nothing.
Yeah.
But it was just something to demonstrate that, yes, they were, you know, they had, a little bit of skin in the game.
Yeah.
We probably could have asked for more, maybe even should have asked for more. I had the sense after walking out of the on-site meeting with them that that the engineering phase was going to grow. Usually engineering phase for us, we can usually do it in a week. Mm-hmm. And I'll talk a little bit more about what that is, but again, just kind of finishing this story. So we went away. I think we had an additional maybe 3 or 4 conference calls. We actually stood their software up, walked through it, put demo data in it, really got a sense of what it was doing. And then we actually broke down the project into epics and issues in GitHub. Put estimates on all of those. We use an overlay in GitHub called ZenHub, which allows us to get epics and estimates since GitHub doesn't have that functionality. And then we transferred all of that to an Excel spreadsheet, kind of broken down by, you know, major module and functionality in the module. Did rough estimates on that, you know, had the developers estimate how long they think it would take. I usually take a developer estimate. We have kind of a... I'm not sure there's a name for it, but we have like bands of development effort, you know, so we think this is going to take 1 day. We think it's going to take 2 to 3 days. We think it's going to take a week. I think it's going to take a week and a half. And the gaps get bigger, the bigger the component gets.
Yep.
And so I take the developer estimate and I bump it up one level.
Exactly. It's like 20%. Yep.
Yep. And then I usually also add at that early of a stage, I add 20%. So in formal project management, there's certain paddings that you add to account for known unknowns and unknown unknowns. So in that project, we worked on it for a month, and I felt like every time we asked a question, we overturned another bit of complexity. And so I actually added 12% for known unknowns and another 12% for unknown unknowns. So I added 25%. Not only did I bump up the estimate, but I added another 25% just because I had this gut feeling that it was going to get bigger. And so
can I just pause to see so the context? Is your goal while doing this to get to a fixed fee cost, or is it just to get to a level of effort before you go into a time and materials?
Yeah. So my goal is time and materials, level of effort for time and materials. So essentially the client had told me, or the prospect had told me, they thought that the project would be about 75 grand. And I just knew.
Based on everything you told me, I'm like, that's not 75 grand.
Yeah, I just knew it. And so what I realized, I had prepped them a little bit for that. I had told them, but from their perspective, and this makes a lot of sense. So let me finish my story and then I'll come back a little bit to the part, because this is really important. But so essentially, I ultimately got to a number that was somewhere between 200 and 250,000 for just the first of 4 components for that piece of software. Now, it is the most complex. We'll probably be able to do the other 3 for double that if they decide they want to move forward. But that's ultimately where I tried to get them. I said it's roughly 3 to 4 months if I put 2 developers full-time on it. If you only want 1 because you want to spread out the cost, then, it's going to double that. We ended up doing, so they had a number of different assets. We did, I think, maybe 12 UI mock-ups so that they could see a little bit of what it was going to look like.
Yep.
I think that's really helpful for the prospect to see a wireframe mock-up. We like to say we do mock-up driven development as much as possible.
I like that term.
Awesome. You'd be amazed at how often a business person, if you put a mock-up
in front
of them, how much more detail and engagement you'll get.
Is that at the Envision level, or is that a different level? Are you using tools for that, or?
We use a tool called mockups.com, but it's spelt differently. It's like with a Q. So it's all web.
It might be like Balsamic or something like that. Like,
So we don't use Balsamic because not everybody that we, that does development uses a Mac. So we like a web-based tool that everybody can jump.
Oh, is Balsamic Mac only? I didn't realize that. Okay. Wow.
I think it is because I've looked at them before and lamented that I can't.
It's a good, for what you're talking about. Let's just give you some quick context, right? Because that, and stick your logo up in the corner. And so it just helps all the difference in the world when you're trying to just conceptualize and get people to understand. Absolutely.
Yeah. So I knew coming into this, the client would be a little bit, or the prospect would be a little bit shell-shocked by that. But what I put all those assets together so they could see, look, we've done our due diligence. And this was my pitch to them. I realized this is three times more expensive than what you planned. I could have theoretically, I could have made this project come in at around $150,000. That's what my developer estimates would have added up to. But I have your best interests in mind. It's not going to do that. Every time we do a project this big, we find hidden complexity. Yeah, it increases.
And then you're change ordering them to death and they're hating you because they have a budget set aside now that you're blowing through it. Yep.
And I could have assumed their PMs would do the right thing and add the margins. And I didn't. I showed them, look, I'm adding the margins for you. This is the project. This is the amount you should budget. And I have, you know, 80% confidence-ish that will be in this budget because I've added all the padding. So that prospect was not planning on spending that much money, but they appreciated all of the effort that we put in. They understood, because I put in all that effort, they understood where the costs were.
Yeah,
they did come back to us and ask us, hey, can we start cutting stuff out? And we said, look, basically, you already have an application that you're trying to duplicate functionality. There's not a lot of room for us to cut things. We really think this is what it's going to take to replace this software for you. Mm-hmm. And we actually think it's to your disadvantage to try to cut things. We did try to cut some things. They gave us a list. It amounted to $15,000. We actually said, look, you're cutting out some of the things that you said were the things to why to rebuild it. So we're just going to give you the $15,000. We'll give you a credit. And because we don't actually think it's to your advantage to try to, you know, nitpick that amount of money.
Well, then, you know, again, and then like go ask the users how they feel about losing the functionality, right?
Exactly. So
yeah, go ahead.
So we built a lot of rapport with that prospect doing that, and they're currently, you know, they're now, you know, having to sell their leadership team on getting the money, but we've given them all the ammunition to do that.
Yep.
So let me come back to the expectation that we had to fight, that $75,000, because this is actually, I think, a great, you know, a great instance of where the business user was really trying to do his due diligence. He's a smart guy. He's close to the top of the organization. He runs a relatively large department. He's used to enterprise sales and vendor engagement. He's like, this is not somebody who's uninformed at all.
Yeah.
And the point to me was, look, we had basically a non-software developer pick up access and build, build this software in access for us in 6 months.
Yeah.
You know, we think that you're the professional software builders. You should be able to do it in half of that. And, you know, I put my numbers on your time, and this, you know, I came up with roughly 75,000, and I feel like I'm even having some padding in there. Well, I get why that makes sense to him. But the analogy that we responded with was, okay, you know, trying to put it in the manufacturing context. Listen, this is what you ultimately have said to me. What you've said to me is, we've got this guy who's generally mechanically inclined, but has never built go-karts before. We gave him the raw materials, and in 6 months, he put together a go-kart that runs pretty well. It can get us out there. We're running about 20, 25 miles an hour. And considering we had to walk before this, this is fantastic. Now, being professional go-kart builders, we believe that you can get us a car built in roughly half the time that this guy has been. And what we said is, okay, but look, you're not asking us to build a go-kart. We're actually automobile builders, and we're custom automobile builders at that. We don't have an assembly line. Everything is put together by hand, because you have a very custom process that needs a very specific automobile, and none of the off the shelf or nothing in the dealer parking lot is going to work for you. Otherwise, if it did, you would go out and use that, and you'd spend a lot less money.
Yep.
So you can't buy the $50,000, Toyota SUV. I need to build you, essentially a custom automobile,
right,
and we're going to be at the, $2,250,000 mark, $250,000 mark. So that resonated really well with him.
Oh, good. I was going to ask.
Yeah. And, it wouldn't with everybody. You know, some business people are just really locked in. This is, they've always done business a certain way. They don't want to listen to you as a professional. They want to listen to you as a vendor who's trying to, BS them and draw them into spending three times more than they need to. And so, what they're going to end up with in this case, if that was the type of person I'd work with, you know, they would end up working with potentially some overseas developers, a really bad project management process. And they would invest their $750,000, and then they did, you know, invest twice that because they still wouldn't be able to deliver for that. And after investing $150,000, they'd probably pull the plug, realizing that that type of development shop just cannot deliver for them because too complex and they don't have the context.
Yeah. And those shops are good for certain things, but unless they're used to doing some really custom boutique type work, which just, you know, caveat aside, we do that, but like, you know, that's a value prop that we have, in that not too many other agencies based where we are do that. They're like half of our rates, and they'll come in and say like, oh, well, we'll just go in and start doing it for whatever dollars an hour, like what my daughter would make doing it, I think. And, you know, and it never winds up well, right? Like, I admit, yeah, totally. Like, if you need a quick web portal just cranked out in like 15 days, go for it. Like, you know, but if you need something where there's some thoughtfulness going on and some requirement solicitation and understanding of users, you know, and more things aren't tightly specced and defined, it doesn't really work that well.
Yeah, that's right.
I get it. Well, that was awesome. I really appreciate you kind of telling a story, because we all know stories help sort of prove those things out. And is that more of a is that a scenario that happens more than often, or was it, or this particular one, or?
Yeah. So your bigger, you know, your enterprise clients, like you've said, your enterprise prospects, they really have a, they're a lot of times they're more rigid, even if they buy into what you're saying, they might have purchasing requirements that require them to get fixed costs.
Yep.
So the other thing I can do there is, when I have somebody who's kind of in the middle, so at the end of the day, I just simply won't do business with somebody who says, I need fixed time, fixed cost, fixed scope.
Right.
I would just say, hey, look, I'm sorry, this doesn't work.
Yeah.
You can get somebody who will say they're going to do that for you, and you will recognize why 70% of IT projects fail.
Right.
fail to meet their guidelines, because...
Yeah. I know. I hear you. It's so funny. I feel like I've had these conversations all, I was going to say all week, and then it's like all last 20 years. And, and it's funny because I think where I've kind of wound up now is, it sounds a little bit like you're doing, please tell me if I'm wrong, which is, we think it's in this area, right? Like, let's just say for your example, we think it's like 250, 300 for this component. It would take a team size that looks like this and probably this long. But we're going to find some stuff out along the way, and we will let you know if it alters that. But I usually say, we can't sign up for this fixed price. This is basically your monthly team cost. They are your adjunct product team. It's just like they work for you. You're going to get in scrums and, or, you know, sprints and talk things out. And you would think with those types of honest approaches, and this is how it works, and this is how software works, it doesn't go over as well every time. It gets down to like, well, let me see your rates. And I'm just like, oh my God, I just... Yeah. And people don't see, I'm like, my head is in my hands right now.
Yeah. And from their side, it's understandable. You know, a lot of those people, they do have fixed budgets. They're, you know, they're trying to take fees from certain things, or they have some kind of, you know, procurement process where they know if it goes over $100,000, then it's going to blow up on them, and they can't even get, you know, they might internally, they know they're not even going to get somebody's attention for 3 months or whatever. So, you know, some of those things, we're just dealing with people sometimes caught in organizational policies that they can't even get out of if they want to. So one of the other things that I've been willing to do when I'm kind of stuck like that, where I think the person I'm working with, I can actually work well, like they will adopt that process. Mm-hmm. I'm stuck in kind of, you know, a paperwork jam where I've still got to make it look
like a fixed fee. Yeah, exactly. So, and then you've got all the asterisks and Weasley lawyer words in your SOW and everything like that. But like, yeah, the end of the day.
I actually don't do it that way. There's a project management process called Moscow.
Absolutely. I had not used this term, but when somebody explained it to me recently, I want to say like within the last month, I was like, oh yeah, that's absolutely. That's what, yeah. Well, just please tell people what it is, so I don't have to explain.
Yeah, so Moscow is essentially must-haves, should-haves, could-haves, and won't-haves.
Absolutely.
And it's a way to break down the priorities of a project into, priority of deliverable. And one of the things that we have found able to do is if we have a prospect or a client who really has to have a fixed cost project. Like mm-hmm. they have to have a...
Just the way their organization and their procurement yep. process works. I think probably, I don't know if it's the same one, but I had a large aviation company near you where you are as well too. And it was like, listen, that's just, well, you can't get anything through procurement unless it's fixed cost. And I'm like, oh boy. So how are we getting,
So. Yeah. So what we have done is usually they don't have to have fixed costs. They have to have an upper limit. So usually the contract has to have an upper limit. So by the time I'm working with somebody like this, normally I've earned their trust. They understand why software has to be built the way that I've proposed. And essentially what I've done is I've said, look, here's what I think the project's going to cost, but we're going to do Moscow. We're going to do Moscow. And I'm only going to guarantee the must-haves. And the must-haves can only account at maximum for roughly 50% of the upper limit.
Yep.
And so what you and I are agreeing with is with the recognition that if we get close to that upper limit and we can't get more money, because a lot of times these bigger organizations, they have to have a fixed upper limit, but then they can, if they can show cause, then they
keep,
can
yeah,
more.
Pulling it in. Yep.
But I tell them, look, the reality is that contractually, if we get close to that upper limit, the only thing that I'm on the hook for is the must-haves. And this gives me flexibility. And, by that time, well, they might think you're trying to screw me, but usually by that time I've laid out the process. I've provided them with external resources outside level 12, that will testify to how we work,
right,
what we do.
Oops, sorry. There.
By all that time, usually, you need to go back.
You know what? I'm going to, but I am going to stop the video for a quick second just so we can, so we can keep talking.
So when I'm working with a prospect like that or a client, usually trust is developed. And contractually I'm saying, look, I will give you the upper limit amount, but then I'm not going to be on the hook for fixed cost deliverables beyond whatever these Moscows have. Because again, they're not going to say, well, you can't have any, fixed. Yeah. You have to give me some type of guarantee about what I'm going to get contractually. And sure, I understand that. So look, I'm willing to meet you halfway. I'm leaving enough margin in here that should give us room for, unknown complexity.
Yep.
But even then, when I've used that successfully, I really only need it once. Once I do it and people start working with us, they just don't need it again. Now I have had one Fortune 500 that essentially what we would do is we would just she would give me a really rough estimate of what she thought the project wanted. But part of her difficulty was she often didn't have the time to really go through a project, evaluation phase, discovery phase. She would just give me rough ballpark, like sometimes even rough meeting. And I would come and I basically say, okay, my gut is this is going to be X, and then I would triple it, and then I would put an upper limit on it, and we'd do a really rough scope. And the reality is that we were really just getting a pool of money because our contracts, even though they had a fixed upper limit, they were still tying the materials. She knew we weren't going to try to screw her. Like we're not going to bill you for things that we don't do. It's all time the materials. Every timer that I give them has mm-hmm. notes. What did we do that day?
Yep.
And so if they want the validation, it's there. But honestly, by about, 3 months in, none of that stuff mattered anymore. They loved us. We got more done for them than their 27 person development that was devoted to their department. And
Well, that's a subject for maybe our next podcast, but what I'm hearing here, which is great, is it's really, pulling in sort of on the true values that I sort of espouse, or the core values that I espouse, which is you're building up trust. You have empathy for them, and you eventually get to show that your team can do the work. And, it's what I tell my team sometimes when these hoops and guardrails start coming up is it's like, just get through it. All we have to do is be who we are. And this will all work out. And everybody gets all, risk adverse and things like that. And it's like, what do we have to worry about if we just do what we say we're going to go do, right? And you have enough protection in there to make sure. if the unforeseen comes up.
Yeah. And I think the big picture here is if I find somebody who buys into the way that software has to be built, i.e. agile, and they have contractual organizational constraints that require a contract that doesn't look very agile, we are flexible to work with them in contractual terms as long as they are willing to abide by our actual agile delivery process, i.e. this is going to be an iterative process. We're going to strive for deliverables every 2 weeks. You're going to be very involved in this. And if the scope needs to change, we don't care. So you mentioned change requests. To us, none of that is ever contractual. It's almost always just send me an email or we're going to have a decision.
Absolutely.
From my perspective, a change request in the software development lifecycle is exactly what you want. What it means is you've delivered some software or you've delivered something for the user to look at and go, oh, you know what? That's not exactly what I wanted. And instead of that making that a contractual issue where now I'm concerned about development costs and now we've got to figure out how much it's going to cost, instead of going through all that rigmarole and that adversarial relationship, I can now create a synergistic relationship where when the software needs to change because of legitimate insights that the user now has, that is a plus for my business too, because I want the software to fit you like a glove and I'm not concerned about who's going to pay for that addition. Absolutely. And that whole dynamic of the relationship, that's what ultimately gets software built really well. It's not that as the client, you can put your screws into me in terms of this was the cost and this was the scope and why isn't it done yet? If you have a relationship like that with a software vendor, you've already lost.
Oh, absolutely. And I like to.
And it, honestly, if you got software.
Oh, go ahead. Yep.
Yeah.
No, I was just going to say that I hate doing change requests. The only time I try and do them if we're doing an agile project is, obviously if you're doing a fixed fee, fixed scope, and then part of that fixed scope changes, you need to kind of document that because, you know, things can happen. Let's just say that. But I typically don't like to do change requests unless it's suddenly like, hey, we've found something new or we're getting asked to do this other piece of functionality. And let's say it's like an additional 500 sprint points. And you say like, well, we could take 500 off the current board and replace it with this. And they're like, no, we still need all that. And then it's like, okay, well then maybe we need to add another developer or two to this to get that done. And they're like, okay. I'm like, so are you okay with that cost? And they're like, sure. And that's really the only time I like to do change orders, if like you're adding on to the team or extending out the time that they're going to work on it. Otherwise, and you're right. This should be, you're agreeing on these things in an iterative process. You're doing your sprint previews and your sprint planning and deciding what to work on and, you know, maybe moving things around and pushing it out.
Yeah, that's right. And really the change request, whether it's adversarial or not, completely depends on how the contract was written and what the nature of the contract is. Because, you know, as you described it, it doesn't have to be adversarial, but sometimes it is, because as soon as you deviate, you know, as soon as the user or, you know, the business person asks me for a change, I have to go look at the contract and say, well, was that actually in the scope? And
because if we took that example of, it's this procurement thing and they make you have these like must-haves and you're going to go to bill over the must-have. And then somebody said, oh, you know what? We're not going to do that module anymore. And it's in like, there's a chance you might not get paid if you don't deliver that. And that's the only time I ever like to get into that. As we discussed before, we don't like to get into those types of contracts just because it's a little non-agile and things like that. So it's kind of like, okay, well, if we're going to sign up for that, then we're going to unfortunately have to be a little bit more diligent about scope management and change order processes, which is just, you know, for me, just not my favorite part of the business. So
I agree with you completely.
So that's awesome. Listen, we could probably talk for hours and we're both, I know, busy, and I'm trying to keep these podcasts under an hour because I don't think people like hearing my voice that much, but that's me. I can't edit these things. They're like a straight record and go. But let me do this. What's the current sort of big thing that you're working on with your team, as in, you know, we can kind of get caught up in the day to day and cranking stuff out and everything, but are you able to pause and say like, this is what we need to do next year, and this is an initiative that you're working on in the background?
Yeah, so we usually do a SWOT analysis, strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, yep. and threats at the end of the year, and we've actually got that coming around next week, actually, since all of our developers, or since most of our team, much of our team is remote. Yep. We have an on-site just work week. Yep. You know, next week everybody's going to come in and fly in. So we'll be getting to some of that stuff. I already kind of know what's on the agenda. It really depends on the team I'm working with. You know, for a company-wide perspective, I don't think there's any single one agenda item. The development team, we stay really busy. Productivity is really important to me. So, you know, cutting out fluff and really just focusing on getting the work done is important. Yep. One of the things that has done to us, though, is it's made it more difficult for us to get internal work done, to get internal open source.
You're too efficient for your customers.
Exactly. Say it again.
As if you're too efficient for your customers. Exactly. Right.
Yeah, exactly. So we have some internal projects that really could use better documentation. You know, we've got issue lists that could get done. And the thing that currently keeps us from doing that is just, you know, really being focused on customer work all the time. So we've got some discussions on the table about, you know, maybe we need to pull a week out once a quarter for internal processes and that type of thing. So I think that's the biggest thing. There are other, you know, more technical oriented items on our list. Like we really want to get even though we know we're using React, you know, you got to get React, you get Webpack, and you got to figure out all the other libraries you're going to use with React. Yep. And we really would like to get kind of a standard front end, package put together,
which just again winds up being more efficient for your customers, and you can have a faster solution to them, like, because you're not always customizing everything. So
exactly, so that's the development side of things, the more of operations. And then, you know, on my mind is always business development. We're in a very crowded market. To be honest with you, we've just never done well at business development. I am an engineer by trade. I don't particularly like anything to do with software development. And so that's still, you know, top of focus for us to figure out how to fill the top of our funnel with people who buy in. Because, you know, our model, it sounds like, is a little bit different than yours. We don't typically hand off our projects. We want to build them. We want to own them. We want to be there for the foreseeable future. Doesn't mean that a project can't end. You know, we sometimes...
Right. Well, so customers usually ask, I'd say 80% of the time, hey, do you have a team that could do maintenance and support on this? But, you know, they usually do that at the end of the project. In the beginnings of the project, it's like, we're going to transition this internally and everything like that. And then they're like, oh, we don't have the people to be able to consume this. But like, there are some projects where we've worked on, and we forked the code. There's one, you know, there's one or two support types of people, as in support engineers, that can, you know, maintain and report to bugs. And, you know, again, you get into some complexities there, like who works on that? Is it the people working on the new stuff? Do they work on the old branch and fold it into the new ones? And, you know, so those are all a little bit, you know, client specific. So.
Sure. Yep.
Yeah. No, that's great. So listen, I super appreciate it. I loved getting on this. I'm going to actually stop the recording a second, then I'll turn the video back on. We can chat for an extra quick second. But so where can people find? I'm going to link up to your LinkedIn. In the website for your company is what?
It is www.level12.io.
Awesome. So I'm going to stop on the recording. And Randy, thanks so much. And I'm sure I'll put some agenda items us to go over in the future.
Okay, sounds good. Thanks, Jeff.
Awesome.